Now I'd like to introduce our guest speaker for the month of March, and that would be Carrie C. from Harrison, New Jersey, and she will be speaking tonight on her story in Steps 1 and 2.
Hi, I'm Carrie. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is September 6th, 1994, and my home group is the week that was in Net Cong. I always get that out of the way. It's kind of a habit from speaking from that home group kind of requirements. This is weird, you know. One, I don't speak a lot. I took a year off from speaking because I got a little too involved in my ego, with, like alcoholics like to do, especially me, and I needed to get quiet, and I did so. So this is like... I've gone on maybe two speaking commitments in the past year. Three. So this is my fourth. So what's really interesting is I have no idea what's going to come out of my mouth, which is good, because then I'm not going to lie, or at least not intentionally. I really don't know what my current experience with the steps are, because I haven't really thought about it. I've just been doing them. I used to think all the time about like how I'm going to execute the steps. Like it was a battle plan against my ego and my will, and I was just engaging myself some more. and today I live them, and what I like about speaking is that I get to, it's up here that I get to really reflect on what's really been going on, or how do I really do this, and sharing it with sponsees or carrying the message is when I really get a good look at what I'm doing in my life. I think that's why it's the foundation stone of our fellowship. Writing inventory and doing the steps, yeah, it clears me up, but it's about talking about my life that I get a good look at who I am and how I fit in it. Talking about my first step and my story is kind of interesting, because I almost never do that even when I go on a speaking commitment. Because most of the time when I walk into a speaker meeting, I want to get as much information about alcoholism and the program into that 20 minutes that I have to talk. So most of the time I talk in relationship to the first step about craving, mental obsession. I don't really talk a lot about my story. And it's also because it's not really that long. I got sober at 18, and I started drinking at 9. I've actually, as of September, knock wood, I will be sober as long as I drank, God willing, which is it's going to be a really cool experience, I hope. You know, maybe my karma will balance out there. So let me start at the beginning, because I have an hour, and I will fill it. I was born in an Irish Catholic family. I'm the baby. I was born when my mother was, I believe she was 40. She said she was 39, but I do the math. I think she was 40. And my dad was 42. So I was unexpected, very. I was a midlife crisis of sorts. My dad was very proud, though, that he had gotten my mom pregnant at 40. I guess it was a validation of his manhood. Although they complain today because, I'm 26 and I have two kids and they babysit all the time. They're like, when are you going to be less dependent upon me? And I'm like, hey, you were the ones who decided to have a kid at 40. I can't help it that you're 67 now and and you're still dealing with the consequences of having young adults for children. Not my fault. It isn't. Okay, so back to the story. So So essentially I was born into a household full of teenagers, and the second to youngest sibling was 10 when I was born. So and we're Irish, so we have that whole like alcoholism gene, if you want to call it that. I don't know much about genetics, and I don't really know where alcoholism began. There's a lot of theories on it. I don't really know. I just know I have it. I don't think I was born broken. That's something I clear up really right away when I talk about alcoholism. I don't believe that God does it to anybody. I don't think anybody's truly broken. It's my belief. I think it's just a perception that I'm broken that breaks me. Because deep down underneath all of this, there is a divine being that lives within my soul, or that is my soul, that lives within me, and that is not broken. just the names and the places and the faces and the identities that I put on top of that confuses me. So I don't look at it as broken anymore. I look at it as a maze. That sometimes my ego, my self-perception is a maze and I get lost, and sometimes I go right to the cheese. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm studying behavioralism in school. It comes out. so anyway, so I don't think I was born broken, but I was born into a very disorganized household. There are four people in my family who have four children who have a problem with substances. I cannot say whether they're an alcoholic or not, because they do not say they're an alcoholic, so I choose not to. I can say that they have struggled with substances in their lives. There's one sibling, my oldest sister, who does not have an alcohol problem. She gets tired after a glass of wine, which I do not understand. But, you know, she has her own, you know, psychosis. You know, that whole Al-Anon thing, living with alcoholics can drive you crazy. So, essentially, I was born into a household with a lot of alcoholics. And I don't believe that my family situation made me an alcoholic. I do not believe that my parents' failure to do anything made me an alcoholic. I don't even think it had much to do with my character defects. I really think I can remember being scared since I was five. I can remember wanting to be a princess when I was a little girl. Like, I had that thing. Like, I wanted to be the best. I wanted to be special. And I also was convinced I was adopted. I had to be adopted because I could not be one of these people. I believe that I was adopted, and that there was this like family that was wealthy, attractive, and normal, and they were looking for me, and that they were going to come find me, and that I was not one of these crazy Irish people. That wasn't true. Unfortunately, I am biologically related to my family. But the point was is that I had that grandiosity, I had that insecurity, and I had that need to be special for as long as I can remember. I don't know why it's there, but I know I had it. So I grew up in this household, and a lot of things happened to me in my life, and a lot of things happened to a lot of drunks. And when I tell my story, I touch on some of the more painful and some of the more funny things, because I believe that when I talk about alcoholism and I'm talking about myself and my experience and how I got here, I didn't come here at 18 and I didn't walk into the rooms the first time at 13 because I was okay. And I didn't walk in here because for any other reason than I was really desperately in trouble. And I had no idea what to do. And I didn't get that way. I got that way pretty quickly. And it makes sense when I talk about a little bit about my life to understand how desperate I got, why I got as desperate as I was when I came in. I don't think that I would have grabbed onto the program the way that I did if I wasn't as screwed up as I was when I was 18. But so I grew up in this very disorganized household with a lot of drunks and a lot of physical abuse, a lot of neglect, and a lot of stuff went on in my house. And it wasn't my parents' fault, you know. And I don't say that as whitewash. A lot of people get up here and say, I don't think it's my parents' fault, but they curse their parents. My parents are babysitting my children, and we have a beautiful relationship. I have not yelled at my mother in 3 years. And trust me, anybody who knew me way back when, I could not speak to my mother without screaming. I hated her guts. I blamed her for everything that happened in my life. So when I say that I don't think it was my parents' fault, I really believe in my heart that it was not my parents' fault. But they had a lot on their plate. They had my brother John was addicted to heroin. My sister Franny was an alcoholic, and my brother Jimmy was an alcoholic. And I was a little kid. And there's only so much that you can handle as a human being. And I don't think that they realized that there were things that they were not seeing that was going on in my life. And because of that, I spent a lot of time hating myself and blaming them. And as my alcoholism and as my disease progressed, I spent a lot of time trying to die. because I believe that if my parents didn't protect me, that they didn't love me, therefore I wasn't worth living. You know, and we'll talk about it when I get to the fourth step. I can tell you all the wonderful things I discovered about belief systems, but that's just one of them. Just a lot of stuff went down, and I was I got to be a very scared and confused little girl, and I can remember having a nervous breakdown in fourth grade. I didn't know that was a nervous breakdown, but I would cry every day until I hyperventilated. I couldn't feel my hands or my face, and I would just cry. I didn't even really know why then. Years of therapy, some steps, and I know exactly why I was crying. But then I just was confused. And I found out that if I lied, that I would feel less alone. And I thought that's part of where I made the equation, people equals, like, if people love me, people accept me, equals that I'm okay. You know, and I made a lot of equations. I created a whole kind of algebra called Carey's algebra in my life and in my disease and in my sickness. And I made that connection. You know, I found out that if I lied, if I pretended to be somebody else, that I would feel less alone. So I did that. And I'll tell you, I spent 10 years doing that. And you never feel more alone when you're lying. I don't know about you. You know, one of my favorite spiritual teachers, Marianne Williamson, used to say, you know, she'd talk about how you know, we'd put up this wall, this mask saying, you know, like me, like me, like me, I'll be whatever you want me to be, deep down inside knowing that we're not that, and as soon as you find that out, you're going to leave. You know, and so I had this terrifying fear of abandonment. Because I knew that I wasn't the person that I was pretending to be. At 9 years old, I knew that. But I also didn't know how to get people to love me without being what they wanted me to be. You know, and the pain and when they did find out, the rejection and the feelings of worthlessness and the fear. You know, and that was at 9, and that's pretty much when I found out about alcohol. I didn't drink because I liked it, or I liked the taste of it, I should say. I drank because it was a solution. I didn't know it was a solution then. See, I make a lot of equations in my life that I had no idea that I had made. I know that I saw my brothers and sisters drinking, and they were cool. My brother Jimmy thought he was Jim Morrison for a little while, and he like was really cool. And my brother John, I mean, he was my idol. He was the coolest guy in the world, and I would do anything for him. And my sister Franny, well, she kind of lived in her room after she stopped drinking, but when she came out, she was pretty cool too. So essentially, I made another equation that if I drank and if I was bad, I was cool. So I had like this kind of tug of war within me about being a bad girl or a good girl, and most women can understand that. I wanted to be good and be accepted. And I wanted to be that good little girl. I wanted the praise. But I also knew that if I tried and I failed, then I'd be nothing. And that if I rebelled, then I was rejecting you. I didn't need you. You know, and so I did that too. And that was all around the same time I picked up a drink. So obviously I got sober at 18, so like this is a pretty short story. So I'm still talking about 9 because there's not much left. Just a lot of the same stuff. So I deep down inside, I began to believe that I was crazy. You know, I knew I was crazy. And I did things that were crazy. I stole for like no reason. I'd go to Woolworths, man. I had to go make those amends. They were terrible. Actually, they were the most freeing amends I ever had to make, because I got to go into CVS and say I stole $30 from, you know, $30 worth of merchandise from you, you know, 10 years ago. You want it back? It was really freeing, but now that when I go and shop in there, they're like, they know. They're like, oh, they're one of those 12-step people, you know, kleptomaniac. Keep an eye on her. No, but it was really freeing, but I stole. I lied. I acted out, and I started drinking. And I can remember, like, actually my first glass of wine was given to me on Thanksgiving. My parents gave it to me, and I loved it. And I remember feeling really adult because it was, like, in this glass. It was, like, in this awesome glass. And it's like, I never drank out of a glass after that. So I don't even know what kind of glass it is. But it was, like, really cool looking. I felt very, like, dainty. You know, I remember holding it like a snifter or something. Like, I don't know. It wasn't, though, but I just remember holding it like that. Like, I'm cool. I don't know. I thought it was Hugh Hefner for a little bit. Kidding. The first time I drank on my own was, like, when I was 9. And I just remember, I think it was Amaretta. My parents always had stuff like that around the house. I mean, my parents are not alcoholics. Which is poor things. I mean, the poor, you know, if they had known that getting together was going to create four alcohol and drug dependent children, and I don't know if they would have done so, but they got together in the naiveness, and they're pretty normal people. I'm sure they could have benefited from therapy, but for all intents and purposes, they don't have the same kind of compulsive problems that I have. You know, so they were pretty normal people, all considering. And so there was alcohol around the house. There was drinking, but it wasn't the same kind of drinking. My parents didn't drink like my brothers and sisters drank. So, again, when I talk about this, I'm saying that I saw normal drinkers, and I saw alcoholics, and I was drawn to the alcoholic type drinking. You know, I'm not one of those people, you know, who said, well, I never knew you could just have two. You know, my mother would get drunk, like, you know, at a wedding, and she'd laugh and talk really loud, you know. I would get into a fist fight, I would throw up, and I would steal or break something or, you know, I mean, I got a police escort to a rehab. I mean, I was not one of those drunks that just talked a little loud. I mean, I talked loud. I was very, that's the other thing I learned. I was very loud and very, very vulgar. I mean, like, I learned that if I curse and I talk like a truck driver and and if I was like boisterous, that people would pay attention to me, you know, and that was something I craved. So I did that, and I did that with the drinking. Like, I, you know, would come and I'd go to school and I'd have like my bottle of Snapple filled with, you know, Jack Daniels and iced tea, and, you know, and I just thought I was the coolest thing in the world, you know, and I'd be real loud about it. Stupid. I'm gonna get caught all the time because I'd be all loud, you know, like, I'm trashed, you know, and then I'd get caught and sent to rehab, or, you know, my parents would find out or whatever. Like, I wasn't a smart alcoholic. I just was not. I don't think people who get sober young are smart alcoholics. I mean, it's those people who last a long time who are smart alcoholics, you know, who can, like, you know, like, the people who slink off with their bottle. I didn't do that. I smashed the furniture. I wanted to be Jim Morrison at one point. He was my idol, you know. So that's the kind of drunk I was. So I got into middle school, and the facade of being a good girl kind of slipped away. I had felt that pull, you know, like on the playground, I was like a bad girl and I cursed, but in the classroom I was a good little girl. And when I was in seventh grade, the facade of being a good girl fell away, because I went from like this little elementary school, and I grew up in Bloomfield, to like this huge junior high school, and every seventh and eighth grader from the whole town went there. And I didn't have a place. I was skinny, and they were like, this was Bloomfield in the late 80s, so we're talking big hair, spandex, IOU, Cavaricci. That was not me. My mother didn't let me wear hairspray or makeup, you know. I had to, like, put it in my backpack and get dressed in the girls' bathroom. My parents were really strict. I couldn't tease my hair, couldn't anything. So it was like, I was like a total outcast, you know, and I, at that point, was like, I just was like, I'm not trying anymore. And that's the story of my alcoholism. I stopped trying. And I reveled in being defiant and in breaking the rules and shocking people and being rude and hurting people and not caring. My mother, a couple years ago, when the movie Girl Interrupted came out, my mother said to me, she was like, you know, you should watch that movie because it's your story. And she didn't tell me which one of the girls I was. You know, whether I was Winona Ryder or Angelina Jolie. And today, I think I was a little bit of both. You know, I was that depressed, suicidal girl, and then I would vacillate between being extraordinarily antisocial and violent and drinking, or suicidal in my room and drinking. I vacillated between those two things. But essentially, I was extraordinarily self-destructive. So as things progressed, let's just say I didn't do real well in middle school or eighth grade. I skipped by, had to go to summer school for algebra. I went to summer school for algebra like every year. You know, I'm actually passing college algebra this year, and I'm amazed. I'm like, oh my God, I have a brain for math. Holy, you sober up, stop doing drugs, and look what happens. You would think you can add. I didn't think I could add. But anyway, so I struggled academically, and I was I was pretty intelligent. I was in the academically talented students, and when I got into middle school and when I left, I was not. I had gone from like A1 to B2. You know, that's how they did this thing called tracking in Bloomfield, and so my grades had slipped significantly. And if anybody knows what a grade hog I am today, and what how anal I am about my grades, you'll realize that was a really bad thing. I'm like, I'm somebody who will do extra credit to get, you know, to get a 92 rather than an 89. I got 189 in college thus far. Okay, I'm like really anal retentive about my grades and studying. So for me to let my grades go like that and to just give up academically was a humongous thing, because I had a big identity in being intelligent, being feeling superior and knowing more than everybody else. I still do sometimes. But the point is that all right, I do all the time. That area I gave up on entirely. And that was something that I think that for me was really the beginning of the downward spiral, because I got into high school and I never went to class. I don't remember ever doing homework. I don't remember showing up for the first two periods of school. I showed up for history because I liked it and I would debate with my history teacher. And mostly what I did was I either drank or I hid at home. Like, I was one of those kids who would show up for school, go in the front door, and go out the back. Like, and I would just walk out. Like, no one noticed. I would just sneak out by the band room door, you know, and I would just leave. And I would go home. And I would go back under the blanket with my bottle and my cartoons. You know, and that characterized my high school career most of the time. Except for when I was in school, and then I would get suspended for doing something violent. So I was really, really unmanageable. And my parents sent me to therapy, and so I started complaining about what horrible parents they were, you know. And I really wanted my therapist to be on my side, and I was really angry that she didn't necessarily agree that it was all their fault. She said something about me having a borderline personality, but I'm kidding. But I think it was just because my parents convinced her. No, kidding. But I went to therapy, and you know, and I had a quick stay in a hospital, and you know, and the last couple of years of my drinking was really characterized between bouts in the psych ward, flight deck. I went from one high school to another. I couldn't behave. I couldn't stay there. I would get panic attacks. I'd have to go home, and I'd have to get on my couch with a bottle. And when I was in school, I was with my friends doing what I did best, hiding in the girls' room with a bottle. or going to Dunkin' Donuts and, you know, meeting up and getting some, you know, going to the liquor store. So I couldn't handle being in public. Like, I just couldn't, not straight. And I couldn't handle, I would always have, I'd also have, like, different groups of friends. Like, I had a friend for each personality. I had, like, a lot of personalities. When I read Sybil, I was like, oh, my God, I think I'm multiple personality. That's my story. You know? Because I really did. I had a lot of different personalities, and I had different groups for each personality. And I couldn't maintain any extended relationships with any one person, because I had no idea how to be a friend. I had no idea how to have a relationship. So I would I'd have a group of friends, and I would wear them out, and I'd go to a next group of friends. And I'd reinvent myself each time. I was like Madonna. You know, every time I had a new group of friends, I was an entirely new person. You know, and I failed my ninth grade year, got sent to my sister's house. After I got driven to Carrier, sat in the intake office, and I convinced the intake people that I didn't need to go to rehab, that I was okay, and that it was just the drug dealer boyfriend that I was dating in Patterson that was the problem. So I thought that I was going to get away with living the way I continued to live, but instead my mother shipped me off to Pennsylvania to live with my sister, who was in the middle of getting a divorce and had four kids. But she did live in the woods, so it was a lot harder to get in trouble, but I managed. I wound up getting suspended within the first couple months of being in school because I threatened to kill a teacher. I didn't realize that they took death threats that seriously. I really didn't. I was really surprised. I'm like, what do you mean you're suspending me? I just threatened to blow over cars. Not like I'm going to do it. Columbine hadn't even happened yet. I mean, they just, you know, those people in the boondocks, you know, they just take that stuff so seriously. So, like, I think it was the first 2 months of school that I had gotten suspended for threatening to kill a teacher. I was on medication because they had decided I was depressed, so they started prescribing something called Melaril. And anybody knows that that's kind of like Ritalin. You don't really want to drink with that. You don't want to drink when you're on that stuff. Essentially, though, within the first 5 months of living in Pennsylvania, my aunt died. And my aunt was... In the whole chaos of my childhood, my aunt was the only person who really talked to me. She was the only one who took care of me. She was the only one who spent any significant amount of time with me. And she did that because she knew that my brothers and sisters were having problems, and she knew that I needed somebody. And she happened to be that person for me. And she had a stroke in November of that year. So I got thrown out of my parents' house, shipped away to Pennsylvania, and the one person I loved in the world died. And I was screwing up in school already because, you know, Carrie could not behave. Because I got there and I was like, I'm going to behave. I'm going to reinvent myself this time. I'm going to be a preppy, good little girl. That lasted a week. I shaved my head. And I just, from there, it just went down. And I love shocking the what I thought were the rubes in Pennsylvania by my coolness from New Jersey, you know, because I was from a metropolitan area and I was cool and bad and stupid. So my aunt died, and I spent the next year trying to die myself. I attempted suicide 9 times. I had my stomach pumped a handful of times. Sometimes my sister found out, and sometimes I would wake up in the morning and say, oh my God, I'm alive. Should have taken more next time. I just really spent that year trying to die. I felt like any reason why I had to live was gone. And ironically, though, because I was very depressed and less antisocial than usual, I actually passed with honors that year in school. And it's most of it was because I lived in the woods, literally. There was no public transportation. There were no sidewalks. I was in the woods. I could not get out of the house. So, and I got bused to school. So I had to go. My sister, you know, after 25 absences that year, she said, you know, you got to start going to school. So just by virtue of showing up, maybe repeating the year, I don't know, I managed to pass that year and do really well, and I got accepted to a private school. But I was extraordinarily depressed, suicidal, and still drinking. And I went to that school. I lasted 3 months and got thrown out. This is the funny part. I got thrown out by December. I started in September. I spent from the middle of October to the week before, no, Thanksgiving. It was right after Thanksgiving in Fair Oaks. So I was really only in school, I don't know how long was that, like a month, a month and a half. Most of the time I was spent in Fair Oaks, and I managed to get thrown out. I wasn't even there. So my parents had sent, you know, obviously sent me to another rehab, an adolescent ward in Fair Oaks, and I didn't pay attention. I didn't really do anything. But people from the program were bringing meetings in there, and they were young and they were cool, and I kind of liked them, but I wasn't really willing to stop doing what I was doing. So I filed it away, and when I came out of Fair Oaks, I decided that I was gonna stop drinking, and I was gonna stop using. So I started going to meetings, and I wasn't gonna go to AA because I didn't like you AA people, because you were old, and my cousin was in AA, and I didn't want to have to see him. This whole thing, like, I thought there was like one AA meeting in the town of Bloomfield, or the state of New Jersey. Like, I didn't want to go where my cousin went, you know, because my cousin's got about 15 years of sobriety. Two cousins have 15 years of sobriety. And eventually he did save my life and bring me to my first real AA meeting. So, but anyway, I wasn't going to go there because I didn't want to have to see him. So I went to another fellowship, and I didn't get honest, I didn't get a sponsor, I didn't do anything. What I did do is, when they make an announcement in the very beginning of the meeting, they say that if you have any drugs or alcohol on you, you should leave it outside the door. And so I would wait 5 minutes after that announcement and go have a cigarette and kick around in the bushes, look and see if anybody actually did that. So basically what I wound up doing was finding people in that fellowship to relapse with. And that was fun. They were even more screwed up than my other friends, you know, because finding people in the fellowship to relapse with, boy, I felt really superior, man. They were way more messed up than me. So that was my first introduction to the 12 Steps program. Other than my brothers and sisters, and I have to say this, did come into AA. My brother is now sober over 10 years, and or abstinent over 10 years, and my sister came into AA for a brief period of time. She doesn't think she's an alcoholic. So the point is that I came in contact with AA. I knew people who went to AA. I knew people who went to the fellowship. My brother got sober in AA. I don't know why, but I just wasn't going to go there. I didn't want to have to deal with my family, and that's the truth. And I thought that if I went to AA, I was going to have to run into their friends, those people, my cousins, my brother, my sister, whatever, and I was going to have to deal with that, and I didn't want to. So I hid out another fellowship, and I just got high. And it wasn't until I got a police escort to Carrier that I made a serious attempt to get sober, and essentially I'd run away. I was 16, going to be 17, and I had gotten thrown out of that nice little Catholic school, and ended back in the public school that had thrown me out in the first place. My sister and I had the distinction of being the two of the only girls that have been thrown out of Bloomfield High School up until that point. I set a lot of fires. Don't ask. But anyway, I wound up running away, coming home, and I went home to steal because I was a very, very, very big thief in my poor family. I thought they owed me something, so I took it. I ran away, came home to steal. My mother was waiting for me because she was no dummy. She had been around this block a few times with my brothers and sisters, and she went to Al-Anon, and she smartened up. She went to therapy, and she was not going to make the same mistakes that she had made before, which I resented at that time because I was like, hey, you know, they got away with a hell of a lot. I don't get away with nothing. You keep shipping me off to hospitals and therapists. I mean, John gets away with it. Why don't I? And at this time, too, my brother wasn't sober, and he was on heroin. And so, like, my mother had her hands full big time. And she had waited home for me to confront me and to make me go to rehab. And I looked at her, and I'm like, screw you. And I walked off with my friends. And I hung out in the park, and I waited to see what I thought was her car leaving the house. And it didn't, because she was no dummy. And so I went to go break into my parents' house. And essentially she called the cops on me. And I had a big fight with about six or seven Bloomfield police officers. I fought them tooth and nail, bit them, kicked them, screamed like a crazy woman. And they brought me to the police station, and from there they drove me to Carrier. They waited until I was brought up to the locked ward before they left. They literally escorted me with the aide from Carrier into the adolescent ward. Then they left me. So I had, at that point in time, I knew that my life was unmanageable. I knew that I was going to die. But I really wasn't willing to stop doing a lot of the things that I was doing. I just wanted the consequences to end. So I stayed sober on that for about a year. And I lied, and I stole, and I manipulated, and I abused. I thought that head meds were different than alcohol. I had this prescription drugs and alcohol are different. I'm in AA. I could take, you know, more of my medication, and that's okay because I'm not drinking. I didn't really understand that whole principle of abstinence from everything. So I spent a year in AA in a young people's meeting, lying and crying, not getting sober, but thinking that I was sober because I wasn't drinking. And I wasn't taking illegal drugs. There's a distinction. So I wound up getting involved with somebody. I wound up 13. Well, I didn't really 13 step him because I wasn't sober, but but he was like 3 days back, and I'm like, he's dumb and he's mine. So I saw him, and I was 17 when I met him, and I was 18 when we got together, and I drank within, a month or two of getting together with him, because this whole thing of, like, I'll get you sober sort of thing doesn't work. I also stopped taking my medication, you know, like, because I ran away from my parents' house when I was 17, and I moved in with a guy that I was manipulating from AA to stay at his house while I was hiding from my parents. I quit school, and, I didn't quit school, I just stopped going. And I left on Mother's Day, actually, because I was that sick. I hated my mother that much that I left on Mother's Day. I had no idea that she spent an entire week crying because of she lost her baby daughter on Mother's Day with a biker, a big 28-year-old biker. Okay, came and picked her up on his motorcycle, and he was big, hairy, tattooed. My poor mother. So I was living with him, manipulating him, until I found my next victim, which I did, and I went to live with him. And we relapsed, and that was the bottom for me because all denial that I was an alcoholic was stripped away right then and there. And for a long time I was saying, well, I'm a drug addict, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm young, I'm a potential alcoholic, I'm not like you people. I hadn't had alcohol in my system in well over a year, and when I relapsed, I drank, four or five shots of tequila, half a pack of Zima, because of course I had to try that, an entire bottle of Cool Breeze, and that was the beginning. Cool Breeze is what I used to drink in high school. I was being nostalgic. It was only $2.89, though, and it was colorful, so you could pretend it was soda. So I drank that, pretending it was grape soda in school. My relapse, I drank like a maniac. Like, I just drank. Like you wouldn't believe. On the street, falling down, going from bar to bar, because I always dated older men so that I can get served. I'm pretty smart in that respect. Because I was like 80 pounds wet at that time. You know, maybe I was 90. I lost 80. I was 80 by the time I got sober, but I was really thin, real skinny, and I did not look like a 21-year-old, so I looked like I was 12. So I always had to date older men so they can get me my booze. But I went from bar to bar, drank. But the moral of the story is that I woke up the next day at noon, and I had $5 in my pocket, and I was a smoker at the time, and I needed to drink. Like, I absolutely needed to drink. And I had to, like, make that, you know, that decision you have to make, cigarettes or alcohol. Cigarettes or alcohol, two addictions at war here. So I got a lot of quarters, and I scraped up the $5, and I had this, and I remember walking through East Orange, because that's where I was living, and going to the liquor store, and I guess I looked so hagged out that either the guy felt sorry for me and, you know, gave me my my booze, or I just looked so worn down that I really did look like I was 30 at 18. I got a bottle of Wild Irish Rose, which was $2.50, and a pack of Basic cigarettes, and I went home. And I remember just taking a couple pulls off of that. But I remember how I felt that I needed it so bad. After drinking all of that I needed to drink the next day. And I swore when I relapsed that I was only going to go out for that one night, that it was just going to be that one night. And that I was going to go back to AA, and I was going to come back. And I remember saying it, chanting it, saying, you know, I'm going to come back tomorrow. I'm going to go back. I'll come back to AA. And I didn't. I drank for another 3 months. And then I did come back to AA. And by the time I came back, I was homeless. I was 90 pounds. My sister had brought me to Planned Parenthood because she didn't want me to breed. And they did blood work on me, right? You know, because I guess they looked at me. They must have thought I came out of a garbage can or a cardboard box. And they did blood work on me, and they said, you know, we can't give you pills because you're so anemic. You know, you're really sick. Do you know that? When was the last time you ate? Planned Parenthood on Washington Avenue in Newark thought I looked sick. Think about that for a minute. And so my last night out, I was with the biggest junkie in North Arlington and his sister. And my husband, or my boyfriend then, husband now, and we went to the city to pick up our stuff. And we met these people, happened to be outside an AA meeting that I used to go to. And there was a guy standing out in front, one of the few people I actually talked to, because I was really antisocial when I was in AA. I would either yell at you or I would hide and lie. It was like really, really weird. But there was very few people I would talk to. And he was one of the few people that I talked to. His name is Billy. And I use his name now because he's dead. His name is Billy Gagan. And he said to me, he said, you know, you can go downstairs. You know, why don't you come downstairs? You know, you can get sober again. And I remember thinking, again, that pull, you know, go downstairs, alcohol. Go downstairs, alcohol. My ride showed up and I left. But I woke up the next day in a basement. You know, I was a middle-class girl, and I crawled out of a basement. You know, I went to prep school, and I crawled out of a basement and with an ex-felon. You know, an ex-con, crawled out of a basement. I had nowhere to live. I don't even know where my clothes were. I was covered. I was covered. I had spilt booze all over me. I had fallen into a hole in a field in Harlem, because that's where I went that night. And that night, someone had offered me heroin. And after 10 years of my brother's addiction, I said yes. Of course, my husband smacked me on the head and said, "Your brother's a junkie. What are you doing?" So I didn't do it. But the fact is that I was at a point where I so didn't care. Because my whole time that I was using and I was drinking, I said, but I'm never going to do heroin because I'm not going to be a junkie like my brother. You know, and I looked in the mirror that day. You know, I actually was in the mirror. It was actually a storefront. And I saw a junkie like my brother. My brother had been sober then. Because he got sober, I didn't. And I realized that, you know, that all that time I felt superior and was blaming my junkie brother for why my life was miserable. I was the junkie and he wasn't. And I walked about 2 miles to an AA meeting. And I came in. And that's my story. And my first step in regard to it was that I didn't know what an alcoholic was for the first 2 years of my sobriety. I came here, I made coffee. I got a sponsor. I came to meetings. I had no idea what the steps were. I had no idea what the AA program looked like. I got sober in Kearney. Sorry, that didn't come out right. I got sober in Kearney. I never cracked the book. That was my problem, just for the record. You know, they had held a group conscience meeting on me in Kearney because they didn't want me to come anymore before I had relapsed because I was so out of control. They didn't even want me there anymore. I was like, there was like a bunch of people who went there who had done so many drugs, I guess, that they no longer have mental faculties or very little of it. And I was lumped manageable. So when I came in, no one wanted to help me. You know, nobody believed that I was really willing. I spent so much time lying and manipulating and just being, you know, an alcoholic. And I used up, I owe such a huge amends to Alcoholics Anonymous. I spent, you know, from the age of 13 to 18 in here lying, manipulating, using people, knowing, you know, that AA people will do whatever you want, you know, because they have to help you. So manipulating them, getting rides. I would get rides to, like, my boyfriend's house instead of an AA, you know, instead of home, you know. I was just manipulated. I was just nasty and horrible. So every time I pick up that phone for a 12-step call, that's my amends to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I owe a big one. And I'll be paying it for a long time. So no one wanted to help me except for one woman who was the toughest, meanest woman on the face of the earth. Her name was Gina. And God, was she mean. And she call her at a certain time, you know, show up, go to meetings, don't lie, don't curse. I mean, I couldn't do anything. Don't have a boyfriend. God. But most of it I listened to. But I wound up getting pregnant within 60 days of sobriety. I found out I was pregnant by the time I was 60 days sober. Thank God my daughter was conceived after I got sober. That was a good thing, because she's perfectly fine now. But the point is that I found out that I was pregnant 60 days clean, and I had to make a decision. You know, was I going to do this AA thing, and I was going to go on the rest of my life and be a responsible adult, or was I going to drink and die? And God graced me with the ability to make the right decision. And for the first year of sobriety, I stayed sober because somebody lived within me. You know, and I didn't kill myself because somebody lived within me. And when she was born and I held her in my arms, it was the first time since my aunt died, I had felt love for anybody in my life. And I could live and stay sober because I loved her. And that was enough to keep me sober long enough to find the big book. And I'd moved out of Kearney, and I was living in Staten Island, and one of my good friends from Kearney ended up going up to the Wilson house and, you know, hearing this guy named Wally P. speak, and he came back with this manuscript. It was before Back to Basics was even published, and he said, you know, kid, you got to read this. I didn't know that he meant, you know, he meant it because I was a really, really sick little girl. I thought it was because he, you know, he gave it to me, and he was like, please read this, and you need to read this. And I did. And at the same time, I was sitting in meetings, and there was a group out in Staten Island called Common Solution who worked the steps out of the big book. And so all of a sudden, this stuff just opened up within me. My husband found a bunch of guys who worked the steps, and I went to a group in someone's house, and I went through the first three steps. Took me a little while to do my fourth step, but I went through the first three steps, and that's when I learned what an alcoholic is. That's where I learned about craving. That's where I learned about the mental obsession. That's when I learned that day when I had drank all the alcohol I could possibly fit in my body before I passed out, and I woke up the next day and I needed to drink, that was craving. I didn't know what that was. I just thought to myself, my God, I thought, you're such a failure. You're not worth living. What are you doing? I had no idea that I was in the grips of something so much more powerful than myself. Today I'm in the grips of something so much more powerful than myself, but it's a whole nother thing. But I had no idea. And when these people explained it to me, years of self-loathing slipped away. I had a lot more left, but a lot of the self-loathing that I had slipped away. And that's when I learned about the unmanageability of alcoholism. Because I really thought that if I put down the bottle that I was going to be okay and my life was going to be all right, but it wasn't. I had a huge violent temper. I was very Irish. The only person I never hit was my kid. But I used to throw remote controls at the wall all the time. I was like one of those people. I had a really, really bad temper. I still had a hard time making friends, staying friends with people. I had a hard time. I couldn't get up and get a cup of coffee in a meeting because I was so paralyzed by fear I would have a panic attack. And that was my first 2 years of sobriety. I had no idea that that was the spiritual illness of alcoholism. I had no idea. I just thought that I was crazy. You know, my whole life people used to tell me, you're crazy. I was in psych wards. I was in with the crazy people. I had been in 4-point restraints. I was crazy. And so when I got sober and I wasn't fixed, when I put down alcohol and I wasn't fixed, I was like, okay, I'm crazy. I'm just going to have to be crazy. And when this person explained to me that it was the unmanageability and the spiritual sickness of alcoholism, I mean, I just remember sitting there thinking, oh my God, it's not me. You know, I'm not a cancer. I felt like I was a cancer. I felt like that I was just a walking human cancer. And I was in a lot of ways, but that's the way I felt in my life. And when this person explained this to me, and his name was Tom, I was like, oh my God. And I didn't really get the second step until I had gone through the steps the second time. Because when I went through the steps that time, I was a little less than honest. And I think I was trying out the steps, in a sense. I still wasn't sure if I was going to do this thing, but I tried them out. I wrote a four-step. It was as honest as I could possibly get at that point. But because the second step, you know, it says that, you know, when I seek sanity, you know, and I acknowledge my insanity, and when I believe in a power greater than myself, or I come to believe in a power greater than myself, can restore me to sanity, means that I'm going to have to actually start doing the actions that unblock me so that I can be restored to sanity, so I can get in touch with this higher power within me. And so the second step really happened when I became honest on my fourth step. It's just kind of weird. I'm backwards that way. I mean, I understood it intellectually. Like, I can remember being in meetings because I was a thumper. I was such a nasty thumper. I hadn't even really been honest about the steps, but I would go to meetings and I'm like, I'm a big book thumper and I'm better than you. I don't do that anymore. But I remember going to meetings because Staten Island was really bad. They didn't even read the book in the step meetings. Like, they would have a speaker on the first step. They didn't actually, like, have a step book there. And that was, like, practice. So, like, they actually didn't have books nor read the step. You got to read it first before you talk about it, just my opinion. or do it, actually, but again. So I would sit there, feel all superior, and be like, you know, and people would be like, you know, well, I have anxiety problems, and that's my insanity, and I have this, and that's my insanity. And I remember thinking, like, no, the insanity is the belief that alcohol is my answer. Bottom line, it's curing the headache with the hammer. That's the insanity that the big book is talking about. I used to sit there and get all indignant. Don't you people know what insanity really is? But the truth was is that I didn't really, really come to believe in a power greater than myself that restored me to sanity until I'd gone through the steps a second time. I tried them on. I liked how they looked. And when I got enough pain, I did them again, and I did them for real. And that's kind of hard, though, because like, I had this whole thumper thing. Like, I was better than all these other fellowship people who didn't do the steps. And then to acknowledge the fact that I was a little less honest than doing them, that was hard. But I did it. And there's a line, and there's a lot of stuff in We Agnostics that, I mean, that chapter is like my favorite chapter in the book, next to Working with Others and to the Wives and the Family. I'm like one of these people, I love the lost chapters. And We Agnostics is often so overlooked. There's so much in there. There's so much about how to relate to God in there. I had no idea how to relate to God. I mean, like, I believed in this chess-playing God. I hated God. I blamed God. I mean, like, I just had such a love-hate relationship with God. You know, I had no problem calling on him when I was in trouble, but essentially, most of the time, I blamed him for my problems. I blamed him for giving me such messed up parents. Then when I heard this crazy person say, you know, that we chose our parents, I hated them too. Oh my God, did I hate them. What do you mean I chose those crazy people? They messed me up. But anyway, so I had this really, really huge problem with God, and I hated God. And when I began to conceive of a power greater than myself, or when I began to try to get a relationship with a power greater than myself, it happened really slowly. It wasn't even a conscious thing for me. Like, I'm trying to think of it, and like, it happened, and it's still happening. Like, the second step is still happening for me. I think that if there's two steps that I, or if there's several steps that I constantly have a relationship with, it's 2, 11, and 12. You know, everything else I do, but those are the steps that are still unfolding in my life and affecting me so greatly. I'm not always writing a four-step. Well, I used to, but not anymore. I used to write four steps a year. I was really anal about that. But the point is that those are steps that the second step is still unfolding for me, and God is still revealing himself to me. But I think when I first really began to believe and trust in something greater than myself was when I began to see that there were people in AA who were happy, because I really wasn't happy. Even working the steps out of the big book, I wasn't happy. And I wound up going to this meeting in Bernardsville, and there were these people who talked about the steps, and they knew more than me, which was interesting. And it's nice to, like, I was like a big fish in a little pond, and then I went to this big pond, I'm like, oh my God, my ego took a beating then. But I saw these people who were happy, you know, and I began to believe in the power beyond the steps, not just the steps. For a long time, I had just believed in the steps. It's kind of like being in boot camp. If I just show up and do it, you know, if you build it, it will come, sort of stuff. But I hadn't really believed that there was a spirit beneath all this, or that there was like this underlying intelligence, that there was this beautiful, beautiful love. And, you know, in that book, it talks about it everywhere. And I didn't see those things. I heard dot your I's and cross your T's. And when I went to this meeting, there were people who had an experience with those things, who actually had a relationship with God. And they had talked about this thing called the second step proposition, was something that I completely avoided. And it was, you know, whether God was everything or God was nothing. And what was my choice? Now, when I look at that statement, there's a lot of different ways to look at it. And I'm one of these like really weird people there is. And I look at it as if God is everything and nothing. Because there is no nothing. Nothing is not empty. It is. So when I think God is everything, God is everything and God is nothing at the same time. I don't have to make that choice anymore. It's not as black and white for me as it was when I first got introduced to that statement. But when I thought about God being everything, it was like, was God everything, like, was it the trees or the rocks? Or was God everything within me? Because there was a lot of my life that God was not a part of. There was a lot of the unmanageability that I talked about, the sickness that I talked about when I was drinking, that played out in my life when I was sober. And God was only two things. It was involved with me not drinking, and it was involved with me not drinking. One thing, really. It wasn't involved in my relationships with men. Was involved with my relationship with my children, which was an amazing thing. For whatever reason, I ended up being a pretty decent mom. It's like crazy, because I was psychotic, but I was a good mom. Yeah. I don't know about that. But probably because I was a big kid. But it wasn't involved in my money matters. It wasn't involved in my friendships. It wasn't involved in any other relationship other than my relationship with alcohol and my relationship with my daughter and my son. When I began to think about whether God was everything or God was nothing, I had to ask myself, is God everything within me? And if God is everything within me, if I am a part of God, and there's nothing of me that is not a part of God, isn't God involved in everything that I do and everything that I touch? You know, and so where I saw that Carrie could be a bad girl, or Carrie was no good, or Carrie was a failure, and when Carrie was nothing, because I was either all or nothing. I was either a star or a failure. When I saw that God could be involved in all parts of me and everything that I touched and everything that I did, then there was nothing that I did that was dirty or that was a failure or that was worthless. And I think that for me, the second step was the first time in my life where there wasn't a part of me that didn't feel worthless. For the first time in my life, I felt like I had some sort of worth as a person. You know, and for me, that was the foundation of everything else. The first step is just gets me in the door. It's the second step that lays. That's my belief. Of course, I rewrite the big book all the time, and I say it's a foundation of willingness. But for me, my real recovery began with the second step. And it began with that feeling for the first time that I wasn't nothing. And that there was something greater than me, and it was within me, and it was a part of everything that I was and everything that I did. You know, and it took two four steps to get there. And it took bunch of sponsors and a lot of meetings and a lot of really awesome people who held my hand along the way, Mike being one of them, Kathy being one of them. I mean, it just was an amazing thing for me. And I think we're about out of time, right? Or are we good? Oh, I got 1 minute. I'm kidding. But essentially, you know, that for me is my current experience with the second step. And as far as unmanageability in the first step, because I'm human. See, I used to think that I was a spiritual a human being trying to have a spiritual experience, and that's not my belief anymore. My beliefs change over the years. My God, if I had taped myself way back then and listened to the stuff that I today, and when 10 years from now, God willing, if I'm sober, I'm sure it'll be different. But today I believe that I'm a spiritual being having a human experience. So I have all the limitations of being a human. And what that means is that I use it as an analogy of a juggling act. That I can be handling one area of my life very well, and God's there all the time, and there's another area of my life that sort of slips away. And then I realize it because I feel the consequences of it, and I turn my attention to that area, and I get God, and we get in that area, and God and I dig it away, all the stuff that's blocking me, and then another area is falling to pieces, and I have to take a look at it. Like, that's part of having the human experience. So, yes, my life is unmanageable because I'm not managing it. I'm going where my attention is being drawn. Again, I started out saying that my life was a battle plan, and my steps were the steps to me were a battle plan, and they're not anymore. I try to be present in the moment, and I try to go where God is directing me to go. And God directs me to pay attention to certain things, and then those things are okay, and then I'm swept in another place, and I go in the 11th step, when they talk about the stream of life, packing too much. I didn't really understand that, and my understanding of it has changed. And that's part of my second step and my first step in unmanageability. So it's my belief that as a human being, my life will probably always be unmanageable if I try to manage it. And even when I'm not, my life will still be unmanageable because that's part and parcel of the human experience. But do I fight that unmanageability anymore? Yeah. But I recognize that fighting it is futile. And so sometimes I don't. And sometimes I'm happy. And sometimes I do. And I'm unhappy, you know, and that's, again, part and parcel of the human experience. But we are out of time now, and I just, I really want to thank you for listening, and I'm really looking forward to being here, and thank you for letting me share.